From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is on a cruise this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. America is engaged in war on two fronts, Afghanistan and Iraq, but there's actually a third.
Let's turn overseas now to a crucial military offensive underway in Waziristan, that's in northwestern Pakistan.
Here's Kabul, here's Islamabad. This is South Waziristan.
Our not-so-secret war in Pakistan is actually bigger under President Obama than it was under President Bush.
America's main military goal is to find al-Qaeda members in the Taliban stronghold of Waziristan on the border with Afghanistan. But the Pakistani military is doing the fighting. For reporters and editors, this poses a problem. South Waziristan is the focus for important stories about America's interests, but reporters, especially American ones, can't get there. They must either rely on the Pakistani military for information or risk kidnapping or worse if they travel to the region alone. Yet there's a great deal of pressure to write with a byline that reads South Waziristan. Journalist Shahan Mufti left Pakistan in August. He says the Pakistani military decides who goes where and is incredibly skillful at spinning or inventing information that leaves reporters unsure of where the truth lies.
So we have reporters talking about entire operations and military endeavors and never being sure whether these actually took place.
Once the Pakistani military invited you to go on a ride along, what happened?
I chose not to go on this trip. Yeah, I'm a Pakistani American. I looked the part. I was able to get into areas that another American reporter might not have been able to. Other reporters do not have that luxury, and they decide to go along. And most often, when the Pakistani army will take a group of reporters in, it will be into an area that they had earlier claimed was under the control of the Taliban, and now that they have cleared. You will have controlled access to the locals there who are often have been instructed as to what to say to the reporters before you get there. Most recently, there was an embedded trip during which the military revealed that they had found two passports that belonged to al-Qaeda suspects. This was curiously the day after or the day that Hillary Clinton had suggested that people in the Pakistani government may be protecting al-Qaeda militants in the region. You can often sense it when you are in that environment that you are being taken for a ride. But if the pressure is there to produce copy,
then the Pakistani military makes you an offer that you can't refuse.
Exactly. When, for example, Baitullah Masood, the head of the Taliban in Pakistan, was allegedly killed in an American drone attack, all that the reporters had to go by was the Pakistani army and the government on one side and Taliban spokesmen on the other. It took about 20 days of confusion. One day, Baitullah would come back to life. The next day, he would die again. In the end, Baitullah Masood had actually died. But in that 20 days, this was one of the leading stories out of Pakistan. And reporters were constantly relaying confusion as news.
What about your colleagues in the Pakistani media? Can you get any help from them?
That's a tough one. In the past few years, ever since America got involved in Pakistan, especially with these drone attacks, there is sometimes a hostility because Pakistani journalists, their perception of the American media is that it is squarely aligned with Washington interests.
Give me some reasons.
Say there is a great judicial victory in the country where the country's democratic process sees a great sort of success. And that same day, there is a congressional report that talks about the dangers of the Pakistani nuclear arsenal. Oftentimes, because of the interest of the editors, because of the nature of the news, the American reporters in Pakistan will end up following the news peg born in Washington. The next day, a story will appear, which will be about the Pakistani nuclear arsenal and not about whatever democratic victory some party won in Pakistan. That sort of direction of the American news gives the appearance that the American media is following Washington's lead in reporting Pakistan as opposed to really reporting what is going on in the ground.
When you're there, do you feel like pulling your hair out?
It's very frustrating, definitely, and that's why I'm here, not there anymore. It's a strange war. It's an American war, but there's no American military presence. It's an American war that's being run from Washington and Langley and Arizona in case of the drones. The situation that reporters in Pakistan find themselves in is unlike anything. And most importantly, it is a relationship with a foreign military. And that military owes nothing to the American press. Everything they grant to the American press is a favor.
Recently, New York Times journalist David Rode wrote of his kidnapping and imprisonment in Waziristan. He was held for months. It was a wrenching account of what he experienced, but we got to see some of what the impact of the drone attacks are. He reported on a part of the world where there are no other journalists.
This is the first that we've really heard out of Waziristan. And in the end, it was nothing short of a kidnapping that allowed this picture to be painted. In a way, we are all glad that this story has come out from the few months that he was there. But now we're back to the same old situation where we have to wait, God forbid, for another kidnapping before we know what's happening.
Shahan, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Shahan Mufti is a freelance reporter. He currently teaches at the Kevorkian Center for Near Eastern Studies at New York University. The unmanned drones that were recurring characters in David Rode's captivity narrative are sources of fear and loathing in the region. Their numbers have soared from just a handful at the beginning of the Iraq War in 2003 to over 7,000 now, used both for surveillance and assassination of al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders. The drones are maintained by U.S. government employees in the Middle East, but they're operated from as far away as the American West. And it's that literal disconnection from the battlefield that has made them such a newly popular part of our military strategy. Popular, that is, in the United States. In the Middle East, they're reviled because they don't just kill al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders. Despite their supposed precision, they also regularly kill civilians. Pakistan's leading newspaper has declared America enemy number one, largely because of the drones, which is why Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, during her recent visit to Pakistan, faced questions like this.
The drone attacks are being carried out in our country, causing so much collateral damage. What does Madam or America in general plans to do about that?
Clinton said she wouldn't discuss any specifics of our methods or technologies. But in the war of ideas, ignoring the problem won't make it go away. P.W. Singer, author of Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century, spent years researching the implications of drone technology. He says they're a powerful symbol of U.S. foreign policy, but what they symbolize here bears no resemblance to what they represent over there.
I remember meeting with a newspaper editor in Lebanon. There was a drone flying over right at that moment, and he described how our use of this technology showed how we were, quote, cowards, afraid to fight, and that all they had to do to defeat us was just to kill a very small number of our soldiers. The message we think we are sending may be completely different than the message that's being received on the ground.
Generally, these drones are considered a wonderful idea here. They are, by their nature, antiseptic and casualty-free, at least with regard to American soldiers.
Exactly. I remember interviewing one military officer who described the appeal of these systems being that he didn't have to worry about sending a letter to someone's mother if things went wrong. Mm-hmm. And the use of these unmanned systems have been very effective by the things that we measure as being important to us. So the strikes into Pakistan, we've killed more than 20 top al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders. And more importantly, we've done it in a way that we didn't have to send American troops or American pilots into harm's way. Also, on the civilian casualty side, they are far more accurate than the old modes of war. You know, compare the civilian casualties during the bombing raids back in World War II.
So what are then the hidden costs here that we generally don't hear about in the media?
What we've seen is among some of these remote units that are operating from places like in Nevada, levels of combat stress that are as high as for some of the units physically deployed.
Why?
There's lots of different theories on this. A bomber pilot used to fly in, drop the bomb, fly away. An operator of a Predator drone, for example, will see the target up close for hours and hours and hours, drop the bomb, and then most importantly, then see the after effect. But remember, it's not just watching someone else die. I remember interviewing an NCO in the Air Force. She started to bang the table with her hand, recounting what it felt like to watch American soldiers die in front of her on the screen. And then this leads to the second thing. Right after that, you walk outside and you're not at war. It's like shift work. Individuals each day waking up, driving into work, going to war for 12 hours, coming back home years on end. So it's not just that you're killing and watching people die and it's grinding. It's that then 20 minutes later, as one guy put it to me, your wife is mad at you for showing up late to your kid's soccer practice.
You've said that these images are becoming a perverse form of entertainment.
You and I can go online right now, go onto a site like YouTube, and watch video of combat. The soldiers call it war porn. It's the idea that we can watch more but experience less when it comes to our wars. One of the things I talk about in my book is an experience of getting an email where the title line of the email said, "Watch this." In this case, the "watch this" was of a Predator drone strike. Hellfire missile goes in, hits the target, and you could then watch the bodies riding the crest of the explosion. And that video clip had been set to the pop song "I Just Want to Fly" by the band Sugar Ray.
You dove nose deep into the whole world of roboticized warfare for your book. And you said it's the warfare of the future. What's your thinking as we get more accustomed to using this kind of technology? Do you expect that we will finally have a public conversation or a way of limiting the technology or a series of safeguards?
I hope so. And that was one of the points of doing the book. And the parallels that people make out there to what's happening right now, to give a sense of history, is they say, you know, this is a lot like the introduction of the horseless carriage back in 1909. Or Bill Gates said, you know, we're at robotics right now where we are with computers around 1980. Other people say, no, it's like the invention of the atomic bomb. These are technologies that didn't just affect what happened in war, they changed our entire world. And it would be great if the public was part of that discussion and debate as to how it's going to change our world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
P.W. Singer is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute and author of Wired for War: The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people, this is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. TiVo and all the digital video recorders that followed changed the laws of physics for TV viewers. Time collapsed, and your favorite show suddenly could be viewed whenever you wanted. Great for the TV audience, not so great for the TV industry. Time shifting meant that viewers could skip past commercials, which meant that advertisers would have less incentive to spend money advertising, which meant networks would have less money to invest in quality programming. But it turns out that many DVR watchers, 46% in fact, of those 18 to 49 who watch the major networks on a DVR actually do watch the commercials, according to New York Times writer Bill Carter.
I've always said people underestimate how passively people watch television. I don't know if you remember, there used to be like suggestions that there would be this tremendous move to interactive television where you could pick the ending and all this. And I thought, people don't want to do that. They don't want to think. After when they come home from work, you've been thinking all day. One of the people I talked to specifically said the passive nature of the medium is a factor. You come home, you put on your DVR, oh, I recorded House, and I ordered in some Chinese food. And the commercial comes on. Now I got to stop eating the Chinese food to pick up the remote and zip through the commercial. I don't bother. But it's also true that the commercials are slightly better than they used to be, and they're trying to make them more entertaining. They're putting more of them in high definition, and they're using little gimmicks.
There are four different kinds of ratings right now. They all show drastically different things.
Yes.
Can you explain how they work and what they show?
Okay, so you have what's called the live program rating. That's what you always had. The show is on the air. How many people were watching it while it was on the air? And then you have the live plus same day rating. So that means if you DVR'd the show, the 8 o'clock show, and you watched it at 10 o'clock, that's the live plus same day. Then you have live plus 7 days. And there you see, within a week period, obviously the idea is before the next episode of the show comes on the following week, how many people watched. But there's a fourth category, the commercial plus three rating. And that does not measure the program at all. It only measures the commercials in the program. Over a three-day period from the time it was first on to 3 days later, how many people watched the commercials? And that's the key part of the business, because that's what all the advertising rates are now based on.
So how does the picture differ from rating to rating to rating to rating?
If you're a network program, you have a much lower live program rating than you ever had before. Every year that goes down. But most shows have seen a bump in the commercial plus three rating. Their rating has gone up about 10%, even though only 46% are watching the commercial.
So what you're saying is that that 46% is actually 10% more people watching the commercials than before the DVR?
Yes. In the old days of television, when there was no recording at all, if you had a favorite show and it was on 9 o'clock on Thursday night, and then another network said, I'm going to move my best show there, well, you had to make a choice then. Now you don't have to make a choice at all. The classic in this case, I think, is The Office. It's on at 9 o'clock on Thursday night. That's an unbelievably high-profile time period because CSI, which has been the most popular show on television for years, is also on there, and Grey's Anatomy, which is a gigantically popular show, is also on there. All three of those shows are now hits because of time shifting.
What about shows that are more time-specific? I guess some people time-shift sporting events, but do they time-shift
Rarely.
The news?
Most people watch news programs live. Very little time shifting. And interestingly, this year, the Jay Leno show, a show that was devised to be sort of the counter to the DVR because, oh, it's topical humor. Nobody's going to time shift it. You got to watch it live. It turns out that's a bad idea because commercial plus three has boosted the ratings for most shows. This show, the Jay Leno show, is one of the few in television that has a lower rating for the commercials after 3 days than for the live program. I was talking to an NBC executive who said, everything goes wrong for us. We come up with a show that's DVR-proof, and then they tell us, no, the DVR is good.
Too clever by half.
Yes. A CBS executive said to me, only half facetiously, that when they saw this research and they said, you know, the actual penetration of the DVR has slowed down. It was tremendous for a long time. But there are people now who say, you know what, it costs extra a month, so their penetration has slowed down. But he said, it looks so good, we ought to buy them and give them to viewers free and let them time shift as much as they want because it really helps. That it sounds bizarre, but another network executive said to me, we thought that it was our biggest enemy, and now it's our BFF, the DVR.
Thank you so much.
Nice to be with you.
Bill Carter covers television for The New York Times. Last week, the website of the Long Island newspaper Newsday underwent a huge transformation. Every article on the site now ends abruptly after a couple of paragraphs, some with cliffhangers like this one. Quote, the rifle-toting suspect banged on the door and dot, dot, dot. To find out what happens next, you have to pay the $5 a week subscription fee. You still get unfettered access to the website if you subscribe to the print edition or if you pay for internet service through Optimum Online, owned by Newsday's owner, Cablevision. But could this be a harbinger of things to come? Rupert Murdoch has been very vocal about his desire to charge for all content on News Corp sites by the end of this fiscal year. And last week, New York Times executive editor Bill Keller said a decision was coming, quote, within a matter of weeks on whether the Gray Lady would charge for some of its online content. Cue the jingle.
Present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Stephen Brill is the founder of a company called Journalism Online, which works with over 1,000 news organizations to devise models and infrastructure for monetizing online news. Brill says there's been an attitude adjustment on charging for web content.
When we launched Journalism Online in April, there were all these hand-wringing debates about if people would do it, should they do it, and now every conversation we have is about when and how.
Isn't this something that a critical mass of news sources has to do together at nearly the exact same moment? Because as we heard during recent hearings on Capitol Hill, doing it willy-nilly will simply drive your audience to services that aren't doing it.
No, I think that's completely false. No one's talking about having basic news, you know, the score of the sixth game of the World Series, suddenly have a charge attached to it because then people can flee to something that's free. Once you get past the common news, what every journalism organization has to ask itself is, what can I do that's distinctive and better than anybody else is doing it and get a portion of my readers to pay for it?
I wonder how consumers might pay for this. Do you think the key is just one bill, 10 bucks a month, that would cover all online news, not just from one paper, a certain payment for kinds of coverage, like a sports package?
There'll be packages, there'll be individual things, micropayments, in other words, paying by the article, as well as weekly subscriptions, monthly subscriptions, annual subscriptions. And the main service we're really offering in that regard is not only the flexibility to do all those things, but the market intelligence, the reports from the front lines that we will give all of our affiliates saying, you know what, monthly subscriptions work a lot better than annual subscriptions, or showing people the first two paragraphs is four times as effective as showing them the first paragraph. We hope a year from now, all the different options you and I are talking about will have been whittled down, and there'll be a set of what seem to be best practices for what consumers like the most and what's most valuable for publishers to do.
Stephen, let me ask you about Times Select. It made quite a lot of money for the New York Times. This was a decision to put certain columnists behind a paywall, but it kept those columnists from being easily accessed through Google and other search engines. The Times people felt that they were foregoing exposure to their online advertising by putting them behind that paywall, so they discontinued it. Isn't there some concern that whatever these structures are will deny people happening upon them, stumbling upon them in the parlance of the web, because they can't be accessed directly?
First of all, I think even the Times would say that today that decision would be really different. There are many, many more people online who are likely to pay for content.
And why is that? They're simply just psychologically prepared to do that now?
Yeah, I mean, all the market research says so. Second, all the market research also says that if you're going to charge for anything, the thing you shouldn't charge for are the opinion pages. A third, the advertising rates, the amount you could charge for advertising when they had Times Select, was much higher than it is today because there's now so many websites with so many pages that every publisher is getting a fraction of what it used to be able to get for advertising. The last point is that Google actually can be and should be the best possible sales source for content online. You can set it up so that, you know, Google will still send people to those articles, but then they might be asked to pay.
Are you familiar with what Newsday has done?
Yeah.
What do you think?
The whole plan that Newsday has put into effect has much more to do with Cablevision's competition with Verizon for television service on Long Island than it has to do with Newsday. Suddenly, they've said Newsday is a $260 a year product, but we're giving it to you for free, and Verizon can't give it to you for free. There are four or five newspapers across the United States that have been charging online for a while but giving it away for free to print subscribers. And what they have in common is they're about the only newspapers in the United States that haven't seen their print circulation go down.
So you're one of the optimistic ones? You think this is going to work?
It's not a panacea. It's not, and it's certainly not going to happen overnight. But the New York Times is, you know, I think, a fabulous newspaper, and its website is even better than the newspaper. It's constantly updated. It's got video. It's got really interesting blogs. And yet the newspaper is now constantly raising its newsstand prices. And the better product, you know, which people of a younger generation would rather have, is free. That's just not a terribly logical business model. We need to reestablish the idea that journalism has value, that it's perfectly appropriate and fair that readers pay something for it too. That is the only way to recreate the business model for journalism.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Sure enough.
Stephen Brill is the founder of the company Journalism Online. Newsday told us that 75% of Long Islanders subscribe to Optimum Online or Newsday's print edition and so have open access to their entire website. But there's one person who most certainly does not. His name is Saul Friedman, and for 13 years he's written a column for Newsday called Gray Matters, about and for older people. But he lives in Maryland, doesn't subscribe to the print edition or Optimum Online, and just isn't willing to pay $5 a week for access to the website. He says many of his readers across the country would be in the same boat, so he quit. He now blogs at a website called Time Goes By. Saul, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, with all these layoffs in the media industry, wage reductions, furloughs, you just get up and quit. Are you nuts?
Yes, I suppose I am. I'm sort of contrary, but that's where I've been for 50 years in journalism.
You were a columnist in the pre-internet days when readers had to pay a couple of bucks to read your column. Why are you so upset?
Well, even in those earlier days, if the column was worth it, it would get out in the syndicate, and so you could get some wider circulation. As a result, you get some feedback from people all over the country, which is what any good columnist would want, because we're in the business of communicating, and communication is at least two ways.
So now you're blogging at a website called Time Goes By, and yes. I assume you're making a whole lot less money than you did at Newsday.
A whole lot less, yes.
How much?
It's none.
But what do you think the solution is? Every journalist can't make the sacrifice that you're making, nor can news outlets continue to lose money at the rate that they're losing money.
Well, I happen to believe, Brooke, that the best of the newspapers will make it through this recession and come out whole. You know, I just don't think that we ought to be afraid of the online. A long time ago, when television came into the country, newspapers refused to carry the television schedules because they were so afraid of television.
Hey, Saul, you said you've been working in journalism for 50 years?
More. I'm 80.
So you've seen a lot of changes in the business.
I have. And I've seen a lot of people decrying the future of newspapers.
Are you not in a panic, being able to see through the long end of that telescope all the way back?
I am not in a panic because I can see all the way back. Brooke, newspapers as well as the online will continue, but I don't see how newspapers are going to help much of their bottom line if they charge money. People will go elsewhere.
Saul, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
Saul Friedman blogs on a website called Time Goes By. Last month, John Harris, a longtime reporter for the National Enquirer, died at the age of 76. He started at the Enquirer during the paper's glory days in the 1970s. That was back when Generoso Pope, the tabloid's eccentric millionaire publisher, was flush with cash and happy to spend it. And for a few months, he spent a lot of it on a dream assignment for the young scribe, John Harris. One of his Enquirer colleagues, David Wright, remembers when an editor thought of a lead just begging for a story.
The Enquirer finds utopia. And he just loved that idea. And within an hour, John Harris was on his way to utopia, or one of many. He set off, first of all, oddly enough, for Scotland, because one of the top editors at the Enquirer at that time was Scottish and knew of a little island in the Highlands that he thought would fit the bill.
I think it's called Brigadoon.
When John got there, it turned out to be rather chilly, and Generoso Pope didn't think that fit utopia at all. So he then set off for Greece, and he went around the Mediterranean in Spain. Nothing fitted the bill. The editors were getting desperate, but every week John would move on somewhere else and find a new paradise. And every week Generoso Pope would find something wrong with it. Tahiti looked very promising. And then suddenly it transpired that they had a weekly newspaper. And Mr. Pope thought that that didn't quite fit the description of paradise to have a newspaper there.
There was a place that was disqualified because it had parking meters.
yes. Of course, as these barriers became bigger and bigger, each week the editors tried to disguise the drawbacks, but Mr. Pope would grill them every week, and he'd winkle out of them any drawbacks that happened to be there.
He never found it, right?
No, he went on to Bora Bora, Fiji, Samoa, Molokai, the Seychelles, Sri Lanka. He just went on and on and on for months. And there was no way he could come home because Mr. Pope loved the idea, wouldn't give it up. He said he's got to find it somewhere. So on he went on his odyssey.
Now, David, my understanding is there was never a story published about his search.
No. I'll tell you what happened in the end. He ended up in Western Samoa and sounded like the ultimate paradise. He filed a story from there, and the editors saw it and went rushing in to Mr. Pope and said, I think we've got it this time. This is after 6 months of his odyssey. Mr. Pope scanned the story, and it looked as if this was going to be it. And then suddenly Mr. Pope said, how did he get this story to you? And the editor said, well, he phoned it in. He dictated it, Mr. Pope. He said, you don't have telephones in paradise. Get him home. And that was the end of it.
Don't take this personally, because I don't mean it that way, but this is the National Enquirer. Did this really happen?
Oh, it really did. It really did.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
David Wright is a senior reporter at the National Enquirer. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with an update. Last week, President Obama signed the Homeland Security Appropriations Bill. Tucked inside was a provision related to photos depicting the abuse of military detainees in Iraq and Afghanistan, photos that the White House had agreed to make public in accordance with a court ruling last April. Last May, it reversed that decision, claiming that their release would, quote, further inflame anti-American opinion and put soldiers in danger. In May, Bob spoke to The New Yorker's Jane Mayer.
Seems to me there's two ways to view the question of to release or not to release. One is the truth and reconciliation path, you know, that we need to come to grips with our deeds, come what may. And the other is the sort of Danish cartoons problem, that the exercise in self-criticism just doesn't justify the risk of inflaming the world and endangering our troops.
Another possibility exists too, though, that if you don't actually release the documents, it leaves open to the human imagination what the United States was doing. And sometimes the imagination is even worse than the reality. I mean, if in fact these pictures are less bad than those at Abu Ghraib, then maybe they can put to rest rumors. The other point I wanted to make, though, was that if in fact those photographs show crimes of some sort, then this is evidence that needs to be turned over in some way to law enforcement authorities rather than just being deep-sixed someplace.
The new law signed this week allows Secretary of Defense Robert Gates to prohibit the disclosure of any detainee photo taken between September 11, 2001 and the beginning of the Obama administration by issuing a certificate stating that the release of the photo could endanger U.S. citizens or soldiers. Here's ABC's Jake Tapper questioning White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs.
How is that consistent with the promise of transparency, this kind of blanket power that is now vested in the Secretary of Defense?
Well, the blanket power is based on the Secretary of Defense telling the Commander-in-Chief that the release of these photos would threaten the safety and security of American soldiers. I doubt seriously that Secretary Gates, I know that Secretary Gates won't, and I would assume that any future Secretary of Defense is not going to abuse that privilege.
The signing of the new bill came the same week that the president agreed to disclose portions of his visitor logs in what the White House described as an unprecedented level of transparency. Meanwhile, senators in the White House came to a compromise last week that now makes it seem likely, finally, that the nation will get a federal shield law for journalists. Now in force in most states, shield laws are designed to shield journalists from being forced by the government to share information they've collected on the job. Opponents of a national shield law argue that allowing journalists to withhold information could endanger national security. Advocates argue that for a free press to function as the founders intended, journalists sometimes need to ensure their sources' anonymity. During the Bush administration, there was a lot of pressure on even such powerful outlets as the New York Times, whose reporter Judith Miller was jailed for refusing to reveal the source who outed a CIA official. And of course, there was pressure on puny news producers too, including individual bloggers. C.W. Anderson, who blogs for Harvard's Nieman Journalism Lab, says that this latest attempt to enact a federal shield law is unusual for two reasons. First, it seems likely to become a law. Second, it might protect not only traditional journalists, but bloggers as well. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
We've been hearing about this shield law for a long time. We know it's in about three dozen states, but the idea of a national shield law has always eluded us until now. What changed?
I think the thing that changed was that for the last couple decades, the government had shown a lot of deference to reporters without a shield law. And then, like many things during the Bush administration, a lot of that deference stopped. And I think people running these media organizations decided this is something we need.
What you're saying is more journalists were brought into the dock during the Bush administration who was trying to find out, you know, the source of leaks, rummage through documents and so forth. And then the reporters suddenly realized that they really were lacking any genuine national legal protection.
Yeah. And in fact, the government was sort of taking over state cases and federalizing them. This happened with Josh Wolf out in California.
A blogger.
Yeah.
He photographed a demonstration in which a police car was roughed up.
Yeah.
Since the cars of the local police force were funded partially by the FBI turned his case national, and therefore Josh was no longer protected by the California shield law.
Exactly.
I can't believe I remembered that.
No, that's impressive. Yeah, but that's exactly what happened. And I think at that point, people were like, all right, we got to do something about this. But the Valerie Plame case had the real impact, despite the sort of murky ins and outs of that case. That was the case that people at the Times in particular decided to seize on and say, we're going to make this an issue. So that was the main thing. Josh Wolf case was a big deal for the less institutionalized journalism community. They said, we have to be careful and make sure bloggers and people like Josh, people who maybe aren't affiliated with the big media, are also going to be covered by whatever shield law comes out of Congress.
So how do bloggers fare in the two bills that are currently awaiting reconciliation?
They're not doing well in the House bill. Language in the House bill basically says a covered person is someone who a substantial percentage of their income comes from doing journalism.
So the classic definition of professional.
Yeah. The Senate bill has a much broader definition. Bloggers and freelancers and student journalists are also going to be covered. You know, I think it's interesting. I think that each version of the bill has different things in it that a lot of people would say are good. The House bill has less exceptions for national security, but also a narrower definition of who counts. The Senate bill makes more concessions to national security, but has a broader definition of who counts as a journalist.
Back at the end of September, we thought this thing was dead because the Obama administration said extending a shield law nationally to reporters would create barriers to information that the government really needs to protect us. How did that get fixed up?
You've got two compromises going on here, and one has to do with what the journalists say is required for the public flow of information and what the prosecutors say they need in order to prosecute cases. Basically, the way it's going to work is a judge is going to do what's called a balancing test, which says he's going to balance the need for the public flow of information with what prosecutors are saying they need to solve criminal cases. And I think this codifies in law that prosecutors have to do a lot of other stuff before they can subpoena journalistic documents.
What's the biggest compromise that journalists had to make?
I think the biggest compromise is with regard to their notes. Under this compromise, unpublished notes In other words, notes that a reporter took with a potential criminal suspect would not be included under this shield law.
So then what's being protected?
What's being protected is the information that's included in the actual story.
But the information that was included in the actual story is already public. Law enforcement and everybody else has access to it. Is it the anonymous sources that contributed to the information in those published stories that gets some protection?
It's ironic. I think that a journalist right now would almost feel like, if I want to protect this, I better get this interview in this story. I think if the interview gets into the story, then it's protected. And I think if it's just an interview that sits on the shelf and is never brought into the actual news story, it won't be.
That's very curious.
It is. And I think that it's unclear how it's all going to actually play out, what constitutes information that was never used in a story. I think reporters would have a hard time answering that question.
There hasn't been a vote on this yet. The bills have yet to be reconciled, so this is still a process.
Yeah. There hasn't even been a vote in committee that I'm aware of on this bill, much less a vote in the full Senate. I think people are assuming that because Schumer and the White House and Arlen Specter have all said it's good, that it's going to pass. But there are a lot of moving parts. It could still go a lot of different ways.
Chris, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
C.W. Anderson is an assistant professor with the City University of New York and a blogger at the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University. With the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall coming up on Monday, chances are you'll be hearing a lot of this.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
That's from a speech President Ronald Reagan made at Berlin's Brandenburg Gate in 1987, an important refrain in the American version of how the Cold War ended. But at the time, the famous soundbite was controversial, both inside the Reagan White House and in Germany, where another somewhat more mysterious quote attributed to Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev would come to dominate the narrative of the Velvet Revolution. WNYC reporter Brian Zumhagen has the story of two iconic quotes and the legacy of 1989.
When Ronald Reagan died in 2004, Republicans cited the key line from the president's Berlin speech again and again to portray the Gipper as the man who single-handedly brought down the Soviet Empire. At the height of George W. Bush's war on terror in 2004, Reagan's words were held up as an example of what Republicans called moral clarity. But things weren't so clear back in 1987. When a young speechwriter named Peter Robinson left for Berlin that spring, the only speech he had in his head was that of a different president in the same city in 1963.
All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
That was in a file folder in my mind labeled, Don't Try This.
Not just because Robinson wanted to head off media comparisons between John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan, but also because he'd been briefed by State Department officials that now West Germans needed tact and diplomacy.
Look, they've gotten used to the wall. Don't have Reagan come across as some sort of anti-communist cowboy.
But after seeing the wall for himself, Robinson had dinner with a group of West Berliners, and he asked them, can it really be that you've accepted the division of your country?
And there was silence. And I thought, oh, I've made just the kind of blunder that the diplomats don't want the president to make. And then one man raised his arm and pointed and said, my sister lives just a few kilometers in that direction, but I haven't seen her in more than 20 years. How do you think we feel about that wall?
Then a woman at the table brought up Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev.
She said, if this man Gorbachev is serious with this talk of perestroika, he can prove it by coming here and getting rid of this wall.
Robinson liked that so much, he decided to build his speech around it. But the National Security Council fought hard to take out the line about the wall, fearing it would put Gorbachev in a tight spot with hardliners in his own country. But when the draft went to the president, he reportedly said, I like it. Helmut Trotnow is director of Berlin's Allied Museum, which put together an exhibit for the 20th anniversary of the speech. He says many in the German press reflexively rejected Reagan's message, saying either that it was too naive or needlessly provocative. But he says there was a power in stating the obvious.
Because every German had to ask, well,
Isn't he right? Did we need a U.S. president to remind us that there is a division?
Another statement of the obvious was that the German Democratic Republic couldn't survive without 500,000 Soviet soldiers backing it. Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies historian James Mann says Reagan made this point by addressing Gorbachev by name instead of saying, Herr Honecker, open this gate.
Erich Honecker, the East German leader, was not about to tear down the wall, but he would like at least to have been asked.
As for ordinary East Germans, it's more difficult to gauge their response since they generally weren't able to talk to Western reporters. But historian Ilko Sasha Kovalchuk says, after the speech, more and more people shouted or spray-painted slogans like "The wall must go."
It's often the case in such closed societies that when people get that kind of support and solidarity from outside, that individual people then have the courage to articulate these ideas themselves. And that's precisely what happened after Reagan's speech.
The opposition really started to gather strength 2 years later with demonstrations on the streets of Leipzig, just as the East German state was trying to celebrate its 40th birthday. Mikhail Gorbachev came to Berlin for the occasion, and the media ended up with an intriguingly critical soundbite heard for the first time in this West German TV news report.
Wer zu spät kommt, den bestraft das Leben.
That translates loosely as life punishes those who come too late. East Germans, experts at reading between the lines, took it to mean that Gorbachev would not intervene to put the demonstrations down, a huge change. Friedrich Magirius was the pastor at the Nikolai Church in Leipzig, a hotbed of opposition activity in 1989.
The concrete result was that the police, the army, and the paramilitary forces were all deployed to limit or stop what was then called the counter-revolutionary activity here in the Nikolai Church. But the Russian tanks didn't come again, as they had on June 17th of 1953, and that was our hope.
That hope drew more and more ordinary East Germans into the streets, shouting, "We are the people," and the resignations of Honecker and the Politburo soon followed. The Gorbachev quote became so ubiquitous that some people I talked to for this story thought it was an old folk expression. It's not. But even people who know that generally don't know where the quote comes from. Most people think Gorbachev said it at the Neue Wache, the old guardhouse in East Berlin, where the Soviet leader approached a group of mostly Western journalists. In the news footage, you can hear one reporter ask Gorbachev whether he thinks the situation in East Germany is dangerous. Dangers await only those who don't react to life. That isn't exactly the same as life punishes those who come too late. So where did the famous line come from? Journalist Ulla Plog investigated that question for the Frankfurter Allgemeine newspaper. She traced the quote back to Gorbachev's foreign ministry spokesman, Gennady Gerasimov. He came out of a closed session of the East German Politburo to find a group of reporters who wanted to know what the Soviet leader was saying.
He wanted to give a soundbite.
Plog says Gerasimov, who'd spent time in the U.S. and Europe, knew how to craft a good media message. He told the reporters Gorbachev had said, "Those who are late will be punished by life itself."
Almost everyone in Germany thought Gorbachev said these words on television because the media had immediately begun repeating the quote as if it had come out of Gorbachev's mouth.
As for the Reagan quote,
"Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall."
It got a new lease on life after the wall fell in November of 1989 because it suddenly seemed so prophetic. But Reagan's words almost as quickly became the subject of a partisan dispute in the U.S. about which superpower's leader played a bigger role in ending the Cold War.
If anyone argued that Ronald Reagan gave that speech and therefore the Berlin Wall fell, he would simply be doing violence to the historical record.
Speechwriter Peter Robinson says that record is much more complex. Historians point out that deep economic crisis throughout the Eastern Bloc played a big part in the Velvet Revolution, along with Gorbachev's refusal to intervene on behalf of Soviet satellite regimes. Still, GDR historian Ilko Sasha Kovalchuk says Reagan also played an important role as an irritant.
The fact that he was, in a way, so unyielding and spoke in such an outrageously antiquated way about these societies, that absolutely had a positive effect in the East Bloc, because Reagan described their societies in the way that they experienced them every day, as dictatorships.
Speechwriter Peter Robinson says toppling them was a group effort.
When the moment came it wasn't Ronald Reagan who tore down the wall, nor was it Mikhail Gorbachev. It was Germans.
After all, the president's most famous line, dismissed at the time as the ultimate expression of American naivete, was actually suggested by a German. For On the Media, I'm Brian Zumhagen.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Buolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from James Hover and Dan Mousy, and edited by me. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.